Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm John Stevens, and you're watching Nasty Knuckles.
Listening to Nasty Knuckles, the Hockey Outlaws podcast, with your hosts, Terry Nasty Suttermeyer and former Philadelphia Flyer enforcer Riley Cote, as they go behind the scenes with your favorite NHL players. Time to face off.
All right, welcome back. What's happening, Nasty?
What's up, Rigorelia? What's going on, buddy?
This is it, man. Just trying to stay cool.
It's hot.
Whole studio.
Oh, yeah. Studio AC going, and then you guys cut it off, but it's okay. Nice
and
cool.
So good, yeah. It's nice and refreshing in here.
It is.
Smoking hot. What's going on?
Not much, man. What do you think about the big Florida Panthers trade?
Pretty wild.
With Calgary,
yeah. Big move.
Big move, sending Matthew Tkachuk to Florida. It's sign and trade deal. He's looking at 9.5 for the next 5 years. Not a bad dizzle.
Not bad.
Reminds me of your money you're pulling
in. Yeah, right. Far from it.
Pretty big trade, though, honestly. Mackenzie Weegar going with Jonathan Huberdeau, who had an unreal year.
Yeah.
105 points, I believe. He is not as happy as Tkachuk is. I think he voiced his, you know, concern. And you know what sucks is... you know, he loves it in Florida. I don't know him personally, but you could. I follow him on a lot of social media, and you know, talking to G and some of the guys that, you know, like Goody, like, he's a great guy. But he's pissed. But he doesn't have a no trade, you know, clause in there, and he's for Calgary. To me, like, you're getting two really good players, but their deals are up next year. So,
well, that's it. I think that's why it's so heavy on the package going to Calgary,
right,
is because of that. And I think everybody knew that Tkachuk was moving out of there, obviously. He voiced that. I mean, I don't blame Huberdeau for being upset. I mean,
right.
what a cushy little place to play, and great team.
Taxes.
Taxes. Really, I mean, everything about it.
Good team.
I'd be pissed too. Go up to Calgary, which I love Calgary, but... You know, I can see it from his perspective, right? A little different environments, and but he's gonna have a tough out a year there, and then he's gonna go to free agency. So, but what a ticket Tkachuk signed, and
thanks for
coming. I guess he's happy. Yeah. This guy's gonna go down. This guy's gonna be on fire.
Yeah, I saw a lot of his interviews and stuff, and he was
glowing.
Yeah, glowing is the word. He was, but great for him. And you know, for Calgary, you know, the only thing that worries you if you're Calgary is, like, this guy's visibly upset and he's coming to play there. I could see him, obviously, like we just said, being upset, but, man, like, maybe keep it to yourself a little bit. I don't know. But it's kind of shitty if you're Calgary and this guy's coming in and he's unhappy already and he hasn't, you know, been there yet. So I don't know.
We'll see how it plays out, but
one
thing's for sure is Tkachuk is happy.
He's very happy.
He's going to do well down there.
I'm wondering how much Walt will be down there, his dad.
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, you know, and Sorry, Keith, but as our good buddy Obi says, if you can't tone it, tan it. So yeah, right. Big Walt's going to be down there.
Catching the some rays, yeah. Tanning it up. I don't blame him.
In his other son's in Ottawa there. I have a feeling he'll be in Florida a lot more than he's in Ottawa.
Yeah, no doubt.
Watching the boys.
That's the truth.
Anyway.
Yeah. What else is going on? Ice Wars?
Ice Wars coming up.
Number two?
Yeah, August 6th. Our good buddy Chris Terrian, Charlie Nama. AJ Galante.
Yeah.
We have some news coming up soon about that with us as well, but their second show, or if you want to call it a show, a pay-per-view. First one went off great.
Yeah.
Lots of great tilts, and now there's people coming out of the woodwork. They want to Chuck Nucks, and they're asking for you. They're asking for Riggs.
A welterweight division or what?
I mean, you're lightweight.
Oh, lightweight. I mean, oh, and, buck 80.
Yeah, I know. But, man, is it awesome. It's such a cool thing. And the way they do it, it's the safest. I mean, it's safe as far as... I mean,
well, as safe as fighting could be, I guess,
exactly.
Right? Helmets and MMA pads.
Yeah, and mouthpiece and all that.
Mouthpiece and the whole bit. But
it's awesome, man. And it's really picking up speed, too. It's so much fun to watch. And these guys are into it. And the owners that we were just talking about, Charlie and everyone, and AJ, man, they're dialed in, and they work hard at it. It's awesome to see, and we're hoping maybe have one come here to Philly soon.
Yeah, that's the word on the street.
Yep.
And obviously Philly fans,
they won't
would
like
chew
it.
That up. Yeah, they hate it. They'd hate it. So we'll see how that pans out. But second event. Props to all them for.
Yep.
The hard work, you know, it's an interesting little space, little niche they've found themselves in.
Yes, exactly.
But, you know, it's entertainment and people are looking for something to get jacked up about, and it's a unique little event. So wish them all the best in their second go at it. And then we're going to be slugging it out and checking for charity, you know.
We are. We got a team going in. We're not sure where Big Phil's putting us, Phil Passarelli, but we think 35 plus or the C division. But we got a pretty good team we put together here.
Yeah. Nasty Nucks.
I'll be
squad.
Be on the fourth line. Third line. We're not having four.
I might be there with you there, buddy.
No, I don't think so. But yeah, man, I can't wait. It's a great event, and we got a pretty good team going in, I guess. I say that. We lost every game last year, but it's gonna be a lot of fun. It's a fun weekend.
Yeah, and it's a tough tournament, man. You guys come to compete.
I know.
I was shocked at the intensity. I was hurting for weeks after, man. My hip flexors.
You almost got a tilly, and that's the last thing you want to do these days.
Well, you know, people are mucking it up.
They
and chopping shit up. So I had to lay the smack down. And
sometimes you have to.
Yeah, but hopefully that doesn't happen again. I'm a skill guy now, Nasty.
You're skilled.
You
know, I know, especially with that Toby stick.
Exactly. Yeah, we'll be looking for some snipes and some dishes. Keep your stick on the ice.
I just got to get there. That's the biggest thing.
Yeah, you got to move those pins. You got the quick little pins, man. Move those things.
Yeah, I just got to keep moving.
Yeah.
I just got to keep moving.
Even Sudsy says that. Keep those things moving.
he's the dad that's up in the bar where everyone can see and he's holding up a sign saying 44 sucks. Like, that's my dad. Like, come on, dude.
Well, he's got your back. He's just trying to get you going.
Trying to get me. Yeah, that got me going all right. I'm kidding.
It should be fun. Looking forward to it. I haven't played... Well, besides our men's league there, which is obviously competitive, but this seems to be another level of competition and
there's
intensity.
There's some sandbagging teams, too. Teams that could probably play up. But in saying that as well, though, they do get some high-end talent. I mean, last year, Zegras was playing here. Adam Fox, Kreider,
right?
Joel Farabee.
Yeah,
I mean, he stole the show last year, actually, Beezer.
Thank God we're not in that division.
No. Well, I could fold some towels for their bench. Stuff,
yeah, right. Fill the bottles up.
Never step on the ice with those guys. But it's going to be fun. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, me too. And then our good friend, John Stevens, in the house last week, episode 81. What an awesome dude.
He is awesome, and I know we say it to him, but like he had a lot to do with both of us.
Absolutely.
I learned a lot from Johnny, just a good human being, and man, family guy, and I mean, just does everything. I think I'm sure he would say different, but it always feels like he just makes the right decision on anything.
Yeah.
Like he's just... You know,
such a thorough thinker, right?
Yes. Oh, my God.
Everything is so well laid out, and... He does his homework, man. He puts in the time, and like you said, like between him and Paul Holmgren, my number one fans, and Johnny and I had awesome relationship when we played, when I played, and obviously continued on to now. And his new gig in Vegas, yeah. Wish him the best there. But just so nice to see him and sit down with him and kind of, recollect the past and talk shop with him.
I feel like I was talking to Neil Little today, and I just said to Litz, I'm like, dude, we could have kept him here for 3 hours.
Oh, easy.
Like, telling stories. We didn't really get into a lot of them, but, like, just so many good times with him. And, you know, I was with him 10 years before.
Yeah, right.
You, like, well, maybe not quite 10, but close to 10, and had him as a player. And you talk about a pro.
Yeah.
Like, and I know I kind of brought it up with Billy Barber, just kind of left. Everything was just ask Johnny, ask Rambo what he wants to do. And he was like a coach, but he was playing. He wasn't a coach at that point. I know he turned into a coach, but just a great guy.
Absolutely.
And he learned so much from him.
Yeah, I remember like my first day walking into the Phantoms, and you know, he's a young guy at the time, right? Yeah. And I was like, wow, you know, American League coach this young. And but then you talk to him and obviously, you still connect with him, but he was like very, very deliberate with the way he was thinking and the way he was planning, and much respect for him. Had some interesting sit downs with him early in my Phantoms career, and just appreciate everything he's done for me and just how he coached. And we talk about in the episode just how stoic he looks on the bench, and how competitive this guy is. And how it looks on the other end when the doors close and things aren't going well. You know, it certainly doesn't look like the way it does for the fans. So,
that's right.
But you know, I appreciate that. And we talk about it, you know, like it shows that you have an ability to control your composure. And I can remember that, you know, like stay composed, like keep your composure, you know, because it's easy to fly off the rails and snap and yell at the refs and throw shit, you know. And I know fans love to see that, but it's not exactly good for team morale and right. and obviously for winning games when you're sitting in the box for misconduct. So learn a lot from him on how he carried himself and such
a pro,
like you said.
Yep.
And I think we're ready to rock here. Episode 81 presented to you by Curaleaf Medical Marijuana Dispensary in Pennsylvania as well as New Jersey and a few other states, but we're obviously in Pennsylvania and New Jersey area. So check them out at Curaleaf.com for all your medical marijuana needs. Let's go, Nast.
Let's do it.
Welcome back. I'm Riley Cote.
And I'm Derek Settlemyer. And this week, we are more than pleased to have someone who has had probably the biggest impact on both of our careers, a huge impact for us, Mr. John Stevens. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, guys. Listen, it's truly an honor to be on here. You guys have gained some notoriety with your podcast here, and I feel it is a privilege to be on the show here with you guys today. So thanks for having me.
Appreciate you coming down.
Yeah, Johnny, I mean, let's just start right at the top here. Three-time Calder Cup champion as a player, as a coach as well, you won. Two-time Stanley Cup champion, assistant coach with L.A. You're a winner, and that's we all know that, and we're just pleased to have you on, man. It's so good to see you. I call him the Rambo. Everybody laughs because his nickname was Rambo because he was a warrior, one of the best warriors I've ever seen in my life. It was a privilege working with you and being a friend of yours for so long and the family. And Stacey, the boss, is in the building, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah,
she is here. Make sure I behave, I'm sure. Anyway, let's start with what you're doing, man, your new gig.
Yeah, pretty fortunate. Just took a position with the Vegas Golden Knights. I was in Dallas for 3 years. They decided to make a change with the staff, and all of our contracts were done. I actually had a good run in Dallas. Really happy and proud of what happened the 3 years that we were there with going through the pandemic and everything. But, you know, you're out of the game, and you really have a chance to reflect. I think it's a privilege to work in the league. I think Vegas has been a great team. They've created a brand overnight. Obviously, they made changes there as well, and had the opportunity to join the staff with Bruce Cassidy. I got offered the position and was excited to do it. I'm very familiar with the West, being in Dallas and LA for so long, and joining a team which I think is a really good team and should be able to contend come playoff time. So it was an opportunity they're really excited about, and looking forward to it.
That's great. Good spot for you. Did you know Bruce from the past?
You know, you don't, but hockey's a small world. And when I heard he got the job, I wanted to wait a few days and just reach out to him to see what he's doing for staff. and I went to dinner that night. I lived down in Seattle, and he called me that night. So it kind of maybe there was something in line there. But I got to know Bruce a little bit. I played junior hockey against him. He was in Ottawa. I was in Oshawa. Okay. And then when I was coaching the Phantoms, when I was a young coach with the Phantoms, he was coaching Trenton, which was our affiliate in the East Coast Hockey League. So got to know him a little bit then, and just kind of watch his career, because you know we've been in the game same amount of time. He's was a head coach a long time ago in Washington, then went back to the American League, worked his way back up, and had a great run in Boston. So he's obviously had a lot of success. I think for me as an assistant coach, I've got a chance to work with some great coaches, and I'm looking forward to work with him. Everybody does things a little bit differently. He's had a ton of success. He's been close. Our old buddy Chief, I think, knocked him off a few years ago in the final. But he's been close, so I was really looking forward to joining him, learning from him, and hopefully with my experience can help get the team the rest of the way.
Hell yeah, man.
No, that's great. Great fit. And what are you up to in the off season here now? Just enjoying some family time? Time with the boys?
I do a lot, Riles. And as you know, I live down in Seattle. We were in Philadelphia for 16 years of my family, so we do consider this home. My boys grew up here, so they went to college and played Northeastern, and they got introduced as they were from Seattle City, New Jersey. So I think they're probably the only hockey players from Seattle City, New Jersey. But I think in our business, and you guys can attest to this, I mean, it's a stressful business. It's busy. You work from September on. You work every day, 7 days a week until you're done, and hopefully that ends sometime in June. So I always look forward to coming back to Seattle and get him recharged with the family. It's a great little town. You know, it's all the people and friends that we grew up with. The kids are hockey players as well, so they're on the same schedule. So they come home in the summer. I get to get on the ice with my sons, Johnny and Nolan. There's lots of pros here, Johnny Gaudreau, Tony D'Angelo, which the Flyer fans will get to know, the Robinson boys. So there's lots of players that get on the ice. I get out and run practices for them, help them stay sharp over the course of the summer, and helps me stay sharp as well. But more than anything, it's just a little bit of downtime. This year, especially because I'm making a change, I got to sell a house. I got to find a new place to live. I was just out in Vegas for development camp. So it's going to be a busy summer just because it's a change of scenery, but still going to find some time to recharge the batteries down and see where I love to be.
That's awesome. You guys have great facilities there in Vegas. I haven't been able to go personally to the practice rink. I went to the other one. I think it's a new one now, correct? You guys have a new one there.
Brand new one in Summerlin when you're out in the Red Rock Canyon, is correct.
Oh, man.
Yeah, right. Not a bad place to be.
Maybe we need to ask Stacey this, but I'm hoping you're going to get 3 bedrooms. So when I visit a lot,
that's
the boss. That's to ask her.
You know, it's funny because we went to Dallas and same thing. We ended up buying a house there, and it's just two of us. We bought a 4-bedroom house. So we don't need this much house, but you do. I mean, the kids come for Christmas. You have people like to come visit, and from what I understand, you get more visitors in Vegas.
I'm sure, right?
People that you never come to visit, you're going to want to come see you this year. So that's something that's in the plans. We got to find a place, but certainly going to be more than 2 bedrooms.
Yeah, good. I'll be hitting you guys up soon. Don't worry.
That's great. And, Nolan and John obviously playing pro. So you know, you as a hockey dad, also a coach, obviously nice to get on the ice with them and do what you do best is be a father, but teach hockey.
Yeah, and you know what? It's it's probably easy to say at this point, but my kids grew up around the game with you guys and coming in the locker room and seeing those Phantom teams, and they've always loved the game, I think, because of that. I think we're fortunate. We had really good teams and really good people, and they were really drawn to that environment. If they didn't want to be hockey players and did something else, I'd have been totally fine with it. But they went to college. They played 3 years together at Northeastern on the same line, which
that's
pretty wild.
That's so cool.
They did play in the pandemic year. They played together in Utica the 1 year, but now Johnny's with Vancouver, and he's in Abbotsford last year. Had a great year.
Big year.
Led the American League in shorthanded goals. Really had pop year offensively for him. And he's a good player, and not just because he's my son, both of them. If I was coaching, they have good team values. They take care of the people around them. They make sure they're looking out for everybody else.
Well, who does that remind you of?
Yeah. So, but I do. I enjoy it, and they love to train. They're playing hockey, pursuing their dreams. They're getting paid to do it. Trust me, they get paid a lot better than we did. I said, you guys are making how much? So I was making $24,000 as a minor league guy.
Their agent. Yeah. Get a little cut of that.
So, but they're both playing. Nolan just signed with New Jersey, and their minor league team's in Utica,
right.
And he'd been there before. So they're both still playing. Both, we just got off the ice in Atlantic City before I came up here.
Oh, okay.
And there's lots of pros that get on the ice, Johnny Gaudreau, the Robinson boys. So fortunate to have those guys around and get some good skates in and keep them sharp. So, but they're home. They have the same schedule we do, which is nice, meaning they have an off season like we do, so we get to spend lots of time together. Unfortunately, in our business, I don't get to see them much during the year. Once the season starts, probably see them once a year. It's probably Christmas, and occasionally if we cross paths. You know, last year we were in San Jose, and Johnny was in San Jose at the same time, so I got a chance to have dinner with him and watch him play that day. But other than that, you only get to see him a couple times a year, which is one of the drawbacks of our business and the time commitment that's necessary during the season.
Yeah,
it's true.
No, for sure. And then I wanted to ask, you know, like around coaching, like you've been coaching since 1999, and obviously the game's evolved a ton since then. As far as coaching goes, like has your style changed? You know, your approach to the game changed much? Or, I mean, you've always been a very detail-oriented guy going back to when I, you know, played for you. But obviously analytics have changed. Yeah. Philosophy around coaching changed?
You know, I think I continue to evolve, Riles. I like to think I'm a good student of the game. I think when you, Derek knows me really well as a player, you know me as a coach. Derek knows me as a coach and a player. I mean, I'm a very disciplined, structured thinker.
Right.
So to me, there's certain parts of the game, there's black and white. There's no gray. And I think in the early part of my coaching, that might have held me back a little bit just because, you know, I couldn't imagine not doing it this way. And then you have these creative guys that do it differently but are still great players. And I can never forget Ken Hitchcock told me when I first started coaching, he said, you're going to have trouble with this at first. I go, what do you mean? He said, well, you're a motivated, self-motivated guy, and you're a structured guy. And when a coach tells you to do something, you do it. And now you're going to be telling people to do something, and they're not going to do it, and you might have a tough time with that at first. And it was really good advice because he was right. So like if a coach told me to run 2 miles, I ran three. Like,
right. Yeah, right.
I told you to bump a guy on a face-off, then make sure you're ready to go, right? And so when you're missing assignments to me that are black and white, I think I was really stubborn. And so I had a great experience in Philly, and then I got to work with Dean Lombardi in L.A. And he really challenged me on that. He said, you got to be a little more open-minded. And so what I learned from that is you just got to be quiet and listen sometimes. And if there's a better way, then I'd like to hear it. But I want to know why, and I want to know how to teach it. And I think I've really been a lot more open to that. The part that hasn't changed for me is that I think if you're going to coach people, you have to establish relationships of trust. And I always felt with the Phantoms, you know, it didn't matter if it was your fourth line guy, which Riley was, no disrespect. If it was your first line guy, Mike Richards or RJ Umberger or Patrick Sharp, I felt that everybody had a chance. Guys that you thought were going to make it wouldn't, and guys that you thought wouldn't make it would. And I thought everybody deserved a chance. So in order to do that, I thought relationships with your players is really important. So when you push them, they understood that you cared about them. I think the best players want to be pushed. You know, people always ask, what's it like coaching guys that are making huge money? I said, well, to be honest with you, it's no different. The best players want to be pushed. You know, I had Kopitar and Doughty in L.A. I had Mike Richards and Jeff Carter here. Those guys all want to be pushed. They want direction. They want to be held accountable. They want to become the best at their trade so they can help the team have success. So, you know, I think today's player has changed. We didn't have cell phones. We didn't have social media.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, used to be able to call a guy and he answered the phone. Now you call a player and he says, my voicemail's full.
Can't yeah, right, yeah.
So voicemail is obsolete. So now I've had to learn how to text. So as I'll text you and say, when can I get a hold of you? When are you available? And, you know, so that stuff works there. I'm not a big social media guy, but the players are.
Yeah.
And, you know, certainly the fans are. I think it's helped grow the game. So I think you've had to adapt with that stuff, Riles. And the analytics to me is just more information.
Yeah.
I think as coaches, you can't ignore it because it's not going away. But to me, that information has to help the players and it has to help them now. And it has to help the coaches point in a direction. I think the analytics should support decisions and not make decisions.
Right.
And yeah, Daryl Sutter, I work with in LA, was great with that stuff. Like we get information. He said, okay, his first question was, how are we helping the players? So if I threw all this information at the players, they didn't care. You know, we used to rate the players in LA, and then I give a sheet and a guy like Drew Doughty, and we give him all this information back, and he would look through all, you know, your expected goals for, your expected goals against, chances for, chances against. The only stat he cared about was his rating. All he cared about was what the coaches thought of his play. And this guy's one of the, he's one of the best defensemen I've had in my time in the National Hockey League, and best defender I've ever coached. But he is a free thinker, and I had to meet him somewhere in the middle with my structure and his freedom. So we made a deal. I'll give you freedom with discipline. I'll give you the freedom to play, but you got to have the discipline to play within the system of the structure of the team. So, and again, at the end of the day, I think good players want that.
Right.
Good players want to be pushed. I know they're going to find that out with Torts coming here. I know you guys were talking about that the other day, but at the end of the day, I think there's a lot of respect there, and the players become better at what they're doing, and that's ultimately what they want, so they can help the team have the most success they can.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and the one thing I remember, and you kind of touched on it, is the communication part. Like players want to be communicated to. They want to hear what you have to say so they can maybe fire back and share their opinion, because that goes a long way. And another thing, too, is like, you know, going back to like 04, 05, like you knew all the guys' wives' names and girlfriends' names, which is like a big yeah. piece of like knowing your players, because that builds that trust and that confidence, that two-way street.
Yeah, that's really important, Riles. That's a great point. I think the one thing about the pandemic that hurt us is that, like, we weren't able to get together with the team, and we weren't having functions with the families there. And so, I mean, I remember when I took the Flyers over, Darian Hatcher, who I had a ton of respect for, he was partnered with Freddie Meyer, and I asked Freddie Meyer if he knew Hatch's kids' names, and he didn't. And I'm like, well, how can you not know their names? Like, if you have my partner, I'd have you over for dinner 3 days a week. Right?
So, yeah.
And but it's no disrespect to what was going on. I just think a team that knows each other at that level is going to play harder for each other when it translates on the ice. So I always felt, you know, the team that loves each other is going to play hard for each other. And it sounds corny, but it's true.
Yeah,
I mean, it's true. A tough grind. You're in a really hostile environment when you step over the boards. And there's got to be an element of trust and care for each other that's going to translate into success. I've always felt that. And, you know, those relationships are important. And the communication is probably the biggest thing that's changed. And I think one of those things that has helped me the most is having two boys that play the game. I see what feedback or lack of feedback does to them.
Yep.
And I always tell this story, and I'll share it with you quickly. We were playing on the island when I was with the Kings, and we played in Long Island, up losing game in overtime. And Alec Martinez had a great game and was one of the best players on the ice, but he had this brutal turnover in overtime that ended up costing us the game. And if you know Alec Martinez, he's just beating himself up. So I'm on the plane, we're heading out, and I'm going to watch the game. I said, I'll talk to him tomorrow. And I all of a sudden, I'm thinking about my two kids, John and Nolan. They'd be beating themselves up there. So I slammed my computer shut. I walked in the back of the plane. Marty's there, and he's like, what? And I go, move over. So I said, listen, you know, you had a hell of a game tonight. You know, if we take that last playoff that ended up costing us a game, you're probably one of the best players on the ice. I know, yeah. I said, well, listen, park it and move on. Don't do it again.
Yeah.
But he just looked at me and said, all right, well, if I hadn't have gone back and talked to him, he wouldn't have slept that night.
Right.
Because
right.
he's beating himself up because he cares. And I thought, you know, let's deal with it now rather than wait till later, because that's going to help him move on and get ready for the next game. So it's a good lesson for us as coaches. You know, you're dealing with people. And feedback, maybe it's not what you want to do, but if it's going to help the situation, help the player, help the team, then you got to figure out what's best in that situation.
Yeah, that's good insight for sure. And Nasty's known you, you know, way back to when you were playing and seeing that evolution.
Man, yeah. I always joke around. We had Jimmy Montgomery on a while back, and I was like, Billy used to make me laugh because I'd go downstairs with like a serious question, and I'd be like, hey, what are we going to do about it? Just check with Johnny and whatever he says.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. So sometimes it was like, just touch base with Johnny and Kosher and see what they want to do. And I'm like, okay. So he's like, I'm heading to Delaware. Get me on the cell if you want. He'd always say it, he would leave. But I wanted to bring up, obviously, some of the best years of my life, you know, especially those first couple of years and even when you came. But talk about Billy and Stutzy and our team back then. I mean, what a ride. It was awesome. The team was new. The building was basically packed, you know, most of the time anyway. And the big rivalry we have with Hershey Ross, it was incredible. But we fell short the first year, but the second year we got it done. But it was just an awesome time.
It was, and, you know, it's funny because it's probably the best years of my career were when I came back here. Like, I came back here as a 29-year-old veteran. I'd gone to the Hartford Whalers and played in Springfield for 6 years. My contract was done. The year previously, Billy Barber had taken over Hershey halfway through the year because they had struggled. And then that was when the new building was open up, so the Flyers are moving across the parking lot, and the Spectrum was going to be empty. So everything kind of aligned where Billy was going to come with the team to Philly. They were going to have their franchise here and take over the Spectrum because it was going to be empty because the Flyers are moving across to, I think it was Wells Fargo or yep. Core State Center.
Yeah, maybe Core State.
There's been a million names since then, right?
But five times.
So they called and said, would you want to come? I said, would I want to? Yeah, absolutely. And our son Nolan was born that summer. And I can remember walking into Hollydale the first time, running to Derek and Chris Felix and Billy, because they were getting set up because the rink wasn't ready for a pro team. We were upstairs with all the...
Where Dunlop's is.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah.
Bar is.
It was awesome. But we came there, and, you know, Clarkey was a gentleman. It was brilliant what they did because you had so many parallels to the past. You had Bob Clark was the general manager. Billy Barber was the coach. They used to do TV games probably 6 or 7 times a year, and they brought Gene Hart out of retirement. So Gene was calling the games with Coetzee. And, you know, then they went out, and back then you didn't have a veteran role. So I came to training camp. We were like an expansion team. We had Peter White, Craig Darby, Sean McCosh, and then there was a line of tough guys that went around the corner with – they wanted a big, heavy Frankie Bialos and Brian Curran and Davey McIsaac and Clayton Norris. Some guys didn't even – Tony Horacek. Yeah, those guys were all here. But we had too many guys. But you looked at the end of the day, we're going to sprinkle in some young guys. But we had a really good team right out of the gate, and that's my biggest regret is we didn't win that first year.
Yeah,
because I thought that was a heck of a team. But give Hershey credit, we had a 3-2 lead in that series too, and lost like double or triple overtime in there, and then end up losing game 7, but made amends the next year. But those teams in that building was unreal. Like, they packed out. We had, I bet you we had 10 sellouts a year with 17,000 people playing the style that they'd remember from the old days. And the same thing with the price of tickets, what it used to be back in the
70s. Yeah,
because
no
it was
kidding,
a lot cheaper. But Billy was unreal. Like, Billy was kind of an old school guy. But you're around those guys that have won, you got to understand why they won. Like, if you talk to Bob Clark, everything's about the team. Nothing comes out of his mouth that doesn't steer towards the team. And Billy's the same way, but Billy push all the time. And he always wanted to be better. So as a player, sometimes you could be winning. We were better. So sometimes we were winning just because we were better. We were playing awful. Yeah. He wouldn't let you off the hook. I can remember being in Binghamton one night. We're up 4 or 5-0. He comes in just between periods, just giving it to us after 2 periods. He leaves, and one of the guys, I don't have to tell Derek who it is, but one of the guys, he said, well, he's got to settle down. And I stood up, and Sean McCosh stood up and said, sit down. He's right. Like, shut your mouth and let's get going, because we were awful.
Yep.
But we were winning because we were just better than everybody else. And I think Billy always knew that at the end, when we were playing the best teams, if we weren't at our best, it wasn't going to be good enough. And so Billy was always pushing hard. And he probably had the perfect complement in Mike Stuthers, because Stutzy was kind of even-keeled, even though he was a hard-nosed player in his own right. But he was even-keeled. You know, I think he had a lot of input in the structure of practice. We love practice, high tempo, high intensity, tough work days early in the week. And I think they offset each other really well. And I think they had great chemistry on the bench that really crossed over to the team. So we always had team parties at our house, whether it was Halloween, Christmas, Thanksgiving dinner. And Stutzy and Billy would come by just like they're part of the team. And probably someone that's worth mentioning too is Billy's wife, Jen. She was unbelievable at bringing all the girls together. So the cohesion of that team was incredible. And that's probably one thing that I tried to take out of there into the teams that we coached when I took over the Phantoms. When Billy moved on, I got the opportunity to coach, with just how important that cohesion was.
Right.
And, you know, Philly always had tough teams. You know, we had, you know, the year there arose. You know, we were never going to get pushed around. And quite honestly, when I coached the American League, I thought if you had young players that got intimidated, it hurt their development. Right?
Believe that.
And so young guys that get intimidated, so you might set them back a year or two, and some of them you might lose them. But in Philadelphia, I think we always had the opinion that, you know, these young guys should be able to develop and not be out there and be afraid. It was a different world back then, and it was an intimidating league, and it still is. And I think your young guys, they got to learn to be men. They got to learn to compete and play hard in those situations. But they shouldn't be intimidated to the point where they can't perform the way they should. And I don't think we ever let that happen here.
Yeah, for sure. And it's funny, Johnny, just something popped in my head when the year, the lockout year, when your head coach and we ended up winning. I remember, I'll never forget, we're playing in Albany. And their equipment guy, a good buddy of mine, Jay, and he like came on the hall. He goes, I've never seen a group of men so scared in my life. And I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, these guys all are talking about is how tough you are. We don't even want to fucking play this game tonight. And yeah. He was serious. He was like, they're actually scared to death. And I'm like, oh, my God. Ryan Reddy told us a story, too, the year before. When,
another tough guy.
Yeah. Oh, man, he was tough, Izzy. He was telling us that when he was here, I can't remember who the player was. I think it was Cincinnati, and he was the captain of their team. And it was a Sunday. It was three. They had played 3-3. So had we. And he's like, our bus pulls in. He may have told this story to you, too. He's like, their captain's telling Izzy this. And he was telling me. He's like, we pull down. It's like, we get out of the bus. There's not many lights on in the spectrum, you know. And it's like, guys are like, I think there's blood on the walls, you know, like already just being in the spectrum. And he said before the game that whoever their captain was, I can't remember the name, but he was just like, hey, boys, let's just play smart and not get these guys wound up. They got all these
yeah,
guys.
All his meat. Yeah. Yeah.
He's like, they got all these guys. And he says, he's like, we go out for warm-ups, and I think Josh Gratton had smoke coming out of his nose, and it's a Sunday at three, you know, three on after back, you know, three on three games in a row. And he says, first shift, someone did something dumb, and we, you know, someone grabbed a hold of a guy and beat him, and we're up like 3-0. They come in after the period, and the guy's like kicking coolers. The captain, I told you guys to fucking not be idiots. Like, now we got to deal with this for two more periods. But you're right. They were tough. And the first and second year when you played, Johnny, we had a tough team. And I used to love it because Johnny was a hard-nosed player.
Yeah,
fought,
sure.
Battled. Used to break a branches every game, which I still don't know how you did. I don't know how guys walked after you. Double extra stiff branches. I just remember, like, it was so funny. Like, you would go to take up for yourself, and Stapes or somebody would try to jump in, and you would be almost fighting Stapes to get away. And Billy would be on the bench going, don't let him get into it. And then you would be, Johnny would come back to the bench and be like, I can fucking take care of myself. And I'm just like, Jesus Christ. But it was awesome, man. It was just so much fun to watch you play and how you captained. You were kind of coaching then almost, really. I mean, yeah, like you said, you were kind of a veteran. You played with the Flyers. You went to Hartford. You played there and on Springy and everything. But it was just so much fun. It was like the best time. Like I think I had in hockey, you know, one of the best times those first few years, and then when you played,
yeah,
it was so much fun.
Did you come in as like a player assistant at that time, or you had no intention of coaching at that moment?
No, I didn't. I did have intentions as I got late in my career, but I'll tell you a funny story. But just to touch on that, like we had tough teams, but our guys could play.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know, the year we won 2004-05, Riles was in the lineup every night on the fourth line and was just a menace on the forecheck. I don't think Riles had a fighting major the entire playoffs that year, if I can recall.
Yeah, I don't think so.
But
no.
Drew lots of penalties because it was the right thing for the team. And then when Ryan Reddy broke his ankle in the finals, we moved Josh Gratton up on the left wing with Jeff Carter and Patrick Sharp.
That's right.
And filled in admirably there. So we knew our guys need to play. Chief would work with guys. Forget Craig Berube, who was assistant coach on that team.
Right.
So it was a hard-nosed team. Ben Eager was on that team in the lineup every night. Todd Fedoruk was on that team in the lineup every night. But these guys could play, and they could forecheck, and they could contribute, right? And that's what made it tough on teams. But I got into coaching a little bit when I was with Hartford because I was getting older and trying helping out with young guys. Not so much coaching, but mentoring young players.
Okay.
And then when I came here, I'll never forget this, we lost the first year to Hershey. And we ended up winning the next year, and it was in the Spectrum, was sold out, doing an interview on the side of the rink before I get upstairs. By the time I got upstairs into the locker room, you could hardly move in there. Mr. Snyder was in there.
I've got some pictures.
He was so excited. I mean, just think of a championship in that locker room again after so many years. So I walk across the hall, and I just got my pants on. I got my shoulder pads off, and I wanted to have a beer and say hello to Clarkie and Billy. So we're just talking, you know, just having a beer, relaxing after we just won. Clark, he looks at me and goes, hey, there's Roger Nelson's got a coach's clinic next weekend. I think you should go. I said, oh, really? He goes, yeah. You guys, yeah. You go, we'll pay for it. Right? I said, yeah, you know, I'd like – he goes, yeah, he's really good. He's got something to learn. He goes, you should start thinking about that. So I took him up on it. I went with Stutzy. I probably went 10 years in a row.
Oh, wow.
You get the, it's over a weekend. Unfortunately, it's always over Father's Day weekend. But, you know, it was literally days after we won the cup, and I was still planning on playing, and we just, you know, I was at the top of the mountain as a player, and Clarkie had the foresight to say, you should start looking at this. Sent me to the clinic. You know, there's seminars all weekend long from people in the business and coaches in the NHL. And I thought it was really helpful. And then I played, like, I think I played after the year we won, I only played about a half year. I got an eye injury and then got right into coaching again through the Flyers. I mean, Bob Clark called my wife and told me I was coaching before he told me I was coaching.
Right? Wow. So,
but it's not often you get the opportunity to go right from playing right to coaching.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then not often you get an opportunity to be a head coach in the American League with very little experience. I remember Palmer calling me on the phone and said, "Do you want to coach the Phantoms?" I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Okay, come see me tomorrow." And I hung up the phone, and then I would start shaking. Like,
how do I figure this out now?
But I think he figured I'd work at it, which I did. But he gave me the opportunity, he and Clarkie. And I consider and tell you all the opportunities I've had playing and coaching have rooted from the Flyers, Bob Clark, Bill Barber, and Paul Holmgren. So they're extremely instrumental in my life and still are. I can still consider them good friends and people that I look up to more than anybody else in the business.
Well, that's awesome.
So you went to that coaching clinic, and then you had an eye injury that next year, and then that's how you went out of the game,
right?
Yeah,
so exactly, Roz. I went to the clinic, came back, trained, went to training camp, and then so that was 98-99. So we won in 98,
yeah.
And it was late in the middle of December. We were in Kentucky. I was just boxing a guy out. Slap shot hit me in the eye, crushed the bones around the eye, but really damaged the eye, and the retina became detached. I lost most of the vision in the eye, so I can really count on one eye to see. So I actually rehabbed to the point physically where I thought I could play, but that's when my retina became detached and I had to have retinal surgery. So I was out for probably 2 months where I couldn't do anything. I was in the hospital, my optic nerve was swollen. I mean, there was lots of medical issues. I had to get the bones fixed in my sinus bone, my orbital bone. That was all had to be redone.
Oh, wow.
But once I got healthy, if you guys remember that year, somebody was ill. It was either Cash or Roger had to take a leave of absence because they had an illness.
When Rammer came in?
Rammer came in. Stutzy went up, remember?
Yeah, that's right.
And then so Billy was kind of by himself. So Al Hill had gone on a trip. Homer, I think, had helped a little bit.
That's right.
So once I got healthy, then I just jumped in and tried to help. Because you had the VHS tapes back there. You didn't have the video systems they have now. And with AP, you know, he's still here. We hired the first video guy in the history of the American Hockey League right here in Philadelphia, and that was Adam Patterson.
Wow.
Yeah, nobody had a video guy at that time. Then the next year, Stutzy came back, so we started the year with Billy, Stutzy, and I. Yep. So I still had 2 years left on my playing contract. The Flyers said, just, you know, we're going to play it out as a coach. And early in that year, I think Roger was fighting cancer at that time. So he left and Rammer took over. So Stutzy went back up because he and Rammer had a great relationship. So I was the assistant with Billy that whole year. And it was at the end of that year that Billy didn't want to coach the American League anymore because he'd put time in. And he joined the Flyers as an assistant. So I took over as the head coach of the Phantoms. And that was the first year we went to the new building in Voorhees.
That's right.
So I coached there for from 2000, 2001. Until 05-06, and then I went up and joined the Flyers.
Wow, what a transition.
Yeah. So fortunately, I was in Philadelphia through all those different hats I wore, and so my family had continuity.
Yeah, right.
You know, I finished playing here. I was assistant coach with the Phantoms here. I was a head coach with the Phantoms here. Fortunately, we had success there. And then I was assistant for a short time with the Flyers, then became the head coach with the Flyers. So I had a long run here, which is really good for your family time and having roots in a community, which was a great community to grow up in.
Yeah. I always tell people, I'm like, thank God Hitch loved you. And it's the only reason he probably talked to me was because Johnny, I remember you saying to me, Hitch was asking me about, like, you. And I said, and he was pumping my tires because we've been together so long. So Hitch was always, like, so nice to me. I don't know if you remember before the first game that year, we're in Pitt. And I think we lost 3-0, but Forsberg was on, you know, that year. It was the worst year in Flyers history as far as the, you know, the record. But we competed and everything all through. You took over early on, obviously, in that season, but it was so funny. Like, you know how jacked up I'd be. Like,
oh, yeah.
I was
scaring
Red Bulls and everything. Yeah. And I, like, came into that little room in Mellon Arena, and you guys and Murph were in there, and I'm like, Hitch, you rallying right, like, right on him. You ready to go here? Jesus Christ, young Derek, get out of here. You need to calm down. And I'm like, come on, Hitch, big game, game one. He goes, yeah, but get off that Red Bull, man.
Get off the Red Bull.
And these guys are like, I don't know if anyone's ever, like, gotten in Hitch's face.
No,
right?
Probably not.
And one of the funniest things, and we've talked about this too, Johnny, I think I told you this, but one of the funniest things that ever happened, we're playing, what's the name of that arena in New Jersey? Continental Airlines. So we're playing there, but in the morning they had a flood. in the locker, like it came down through the locker room, and we didn't know if it was from toilets overflow. They didn't know what it was, so I called Hitch, and he's like, "I'm on my way. I'll check it out when we get there," you know. And I'm like, "Okay." So he gets in there and he sees it. And he's like, "Okay, we're not gonna be able to have practice." So we start, Harry and I start taking the jerseys down, start getting the game stuff out, and he goes, "Young Derek, what's that song, My Hips Don't Lie?" And I'm like, "By Shakira? Yeah, put that on." So I just put it on the old iPod or whatever the thing was. And he stood there and chewed gum and tapped his foot. Yeah, the whole entire 4 minutes of the song.
No hip movement?
He didn't do any hip movement. No, thank God. But he tapped his toes and listened to it. And he goes, "Okay, I'll see you guys tonight. You know, let's just bring Shakira, the gang Shakira. In. I mean, yeah, Shakira. We actually put a pretty funny video up of that. But that was really funny. But Hitch was really nice to me, thanks to you. Because, you know, he I love Hitch. But, like, sometimes he wasn't. You know, he didn't want to talk to people, so it was cool that Johnny kind of helped me out there. It was pretty funny. I enjoyed Hitch. He made me laugh, and I don't think he'd ever had anybody like jump try to get him fired up.
Probably not.
No, probably not.
He probably never did again.
Yeah,
he
probably never did. You probably learned a ton from Hitch. Hey, you guys are kind of like unreal. different type of teachers, but he's more like way X and O and no experience with playing and.
Hitch was unreal, and he took over, and I was coaching the Phantoms, and he would have us down all the time. And the biggest year was the lockout year because they didn't play all year, but he was around a lot, and there was like a mirror upstairs. He would stand behind it so you couldn't see that he was there, but he watched us practice all the time. I don't know if you guys remember, we started the year 17-2. At that time, we won 17 games in a row. It was an American League record. It stood for 70 years. Mm-hmm. And he would call me down and say, "Okay, how are we going to get the team to the next level?" Or I would talk to him and say, "This guy's driving me nuts." He said, "John, you're spending too much time. It's not going to matter. Your locker room's strong enough." But he would all the time. Like, I had to give him a copy of my practice plan. He would watch us practice, and he would notice something, and you got to pay attention to this. Your 3-on-2s, your net drive's not hard enough. He has the uncanny ability to be point on when he sees something. So in between periods, or if you're talking about one part of the game, whether it's your forecheck, reload, D-zone coverage, he does it in such a precise point on manner that you get the point right away. You're not sitting there saying, "What the hell did he just say?" Like, the player's leaving, you're confused, saying, "Okay, what just happened?" Yeah. You don't get that with Hitch, right? It's point on. It's very clear and black and white, and I love that about him. So, you know, his practices had purpose. He wanted tempo all the time. He pushed guys hard, and he was very open to me. I'm very appreciative of that. I'm still good friends with Hitch, still talk
That's
to
awesome.
Him.
That's great.
And learned a ton. For a young coach trying to learn his way, having that type of mentor around as much as he was, it was a terrific experience for all of us.
Yeah, I bet. And he probably learned some stuff from you too, right? I think there's always like that exchange and learning from your peers, right? Because you play, you're a warrior, you know what I mean? You're learning, again, stuff that he might not have a pulse on.
Yeah, and I remember one of the first times I met Titch, and I didn't know him very well. We went to training camp, and the Flyers were an unbelievable team then. That's when he first got here, and they're a huge team. Keith Primo is here, and Donald Brashear was one of their wingers. They were just monsters. Back end was huge.
Rathje, Hatch.
I mean, they were a big, strong team, right? So we go to training camp. We're doing all these battle drills. We had all these kids out of college that year. We had Freddie Meyer. We had Randy Jones. Joey Hope was another guy. Wade Skolny. But they're kids. Right? They're going and they're playing against seasoned men on a team that was contending for the Stanley Cup. So we're doing and they were all dialed in training camp. So we're doing these battle drills. So he calls me down after. He goes, "Johnny, what's going on with your defenseman?" I had him a week, right?
Yeah.
He goes, "You mean to tell me we signed all these guys?" I go, "Hitch, cut him a break. I mean, they're going against Primo and all these guys. They have no chance. They don't even know what they're, you know, so much anxiety. They're just shaking in their boots even being on the ice." And ironic thing was, a bunch of those guys played in the National Hockey League, had great careers. You know, Randy Jones and Freddie Meyer, all these guys.
Yeah.
They were just right. Randy Jones come out of Clarkson and Freddie come out of school as well. So it's like, you know, these guys need time. And they were good players. But, you know, Hitch wanted to, now. I want to go now. And he wanted a team that was ready to win. So he kind of pushed those young guys aside and moved on. But that was my first experience with Hitch. But he has pushed his heart. Yeah. And he even, guys that were older guys coming to training camp, going through the motions, he called me down and said, "You got to get on these guys. You know, they don't let them glide through training camp." So
he
was really good like that. And we had lots of conversations. I shared my whole year plan with him and practice plans that year because he wasn't coaching because he saw, you know, liked a lot of things we were doing. I think he probably stole a drill or two. So
I'm sure he did.
And he might claim the fame with Hitch, but he, you know, he's had a ton of success. And I think he's done a really good job as an older coach mentoring a lot of the younger coaches, still does it, and is willing to share his information to help guys that maybe he didn't have when he was a young coach.
Right.
And yeah. to your point there on Freddie Meyer and Randy Jones, like I've always heard that like Hitch maybe didn't necessarily trust the young guys as much and lean more on, you know, the older guys. Would you say that's true? And is that probably why maybe he was like that? Or just one of these guys develop a little quicker than possible?
Well, you know, I think coaches, I want to say back then, I think there was always room and patience for a veteran player.
Right.
I think you always felt that a veteran player had been through the wars before, and when push came to shove in the critical times, like a playoff,
right,
the young guys couldn't do it. And I think that probably held true for a long time. You could have maybe one guy, a young guy, could help you along. Like, you know, I tell people the example with Patrick Sharp. They went to Game 7 against Tampa Bay the year that Tampa Bay won when Torch was coaching Tampa. Patrick Sharp, dressed in Game 7, never got a shift. So, you know, because you didn't want that young guy to be out there and be nervous and maybe make the mistake that's going to cost the game, because the margin for error when you're playing good teams, and certainly in the playoffs, is tight. Like our first cup we won against New Jersey, both games in New Jersey we won 2-1 overtime. So we go home up 2-0, feeling really good about ourselves, knowing that we could have been going home down 2-0, right? So
right.
I think that's part of the reason why coaches, veteran coaches, think like that. But I do think that's changed.
Yeah.
And I think it's changed over the last 10 years. You know, if I look at the team we had in L.A. and the contribution we had from young players, it was incredible. If you look at the Byram kid and McCarr kid for Colorado, I mean, McCarr, he's probably a prodigy. He's probably a generational talent. I mean, I don't think you see many McCars come along, but so, okay, well, we give you that one. But to have Byram come in, who missed half the year, and play as well as he did with injuries on their back end to Girard and whatnot, you know, I think the game is changing where you're getting young players that can handle the stage. And I think because of that, coaches are maybe changing a little bit. But I there's no question back in the day, you know, Hitch would, if he had to choose between a veteran player and a young player, he's going to trust that the veteran player is going to get it done.
Yeah. And I understand the philosophy. I mean, it makes sense, right? I mean, experience is experience. But I guess, like, showing trust in your young guys, too, would generate experience and confidence. But
yeah,
situational, right? I mean, Game 7 is probably not the time to
be
tinkering with that necessarily. But
right, but you still, like, you know, when I was in L.A., we had the young players. Like, Drew Doughty was still a young player. Martinez was a young player. We had the young Voinov kid was a young player.
Yeah.
Trevor Lewis was a young player. Kyle Clifford. Jordan Nolan, Dwight King, they were all limited experience in the league, but we had people around them like Justin Williams and Dustin Brown, Mike Richards and Jeff Carter and all those types of people that, you know, we weren't counting on those young guys to make decisions and lead us in to tough situations. We were just asking them to do their job when it's called upon them, and then we had veteran core group that kind of knew how to react to those situations. So we were fortunate that way. Kopitar and Scuderi. I mean, we had tons of those guys, right? And Willie Mitchell. You go down the list of guys that we had there. Jarrett Stoll. So I think that's important. But I think what I've seen in the last 10 years is that you can't just write off a young player and say, you know, he doesn't have experience, he can't do it.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's been lots of guys that have come in and have done it. There's been enough guys that have done it, you know, every year. St. Louis won. Thomas was a star for that team, right? He was just a kid.
Yeah, right.
Bennington came in and was an unproven goaltender the year St. Louis won. He was a third goalie in San Antonio start the year, and he was the guy that carried him to the Stanley Cup. So I think you have to evaluate your players. I think you have to be objective. You can't have predetermined what they are or what they're not. I think you have to make an evaluation on a daily basis. Okay, he's been in some tough situations during the year. Okay, we put him on a power play late in the game, and he performed. Or he had a checking role and he got stuck on the ice against Crosby and he was able to do his job. And then I think now as more assistant coaches, you spend more time with players, you go over situations, so hopefully they can learn and be better prepared in the critical times that we're seeing now. So I do think that part of the game has changed.
Yeah.
I still think there's huge value in having veteran players that have been there, but I do think you need to sprinkle in some young guys if you're going to continue to get better and stay competitive.
Yeah,
I got a question, Johnny. You're talking about like coaching, and we're talking about Hitch, but Daryl Sutter. I'm like, give us something good. Like, I mean, I can't even watch. I just start smiling when I see him
too.
sitting at the table for his daily press conference. You know, like, and Chiefs told me a ton of stories about, you know, him when he played for him. You know, like back in the day, like he's Chiefs, like we're. we're there early because I was always early as a player. And he goes having a coffee. We got the radio on, and all of a sudden we turn around and Daryl's over there, tie's undone. He's like in his stance, saying, "You better be fucking ready to play." And, and Chief's just laughing. He goes, "Can't even hear him. You can read his mouth," but he's like, "It's like quarter to four. Game's at 7." But like, how was it working with him? Like, obviously, you guys had a, you won two cups together there, so I know it's the answer. It was great, but like. You know, just what did you learn from Daryl or see from him?
Yeah, he's an amazing guy. He really is. And, you know, he comes from a family of brothers that all played the game. And I think he's got some really good fundamentals that are instilled in him from that. I know I grew up in a family of four boys, so I think you just foster this team mantra right off the hop just from growing up. But he's got a personality that's hard to describe. But probably the biggest thing I learned from him, because you go to LA, right, and there's lots of distractions, the weather and what's going on, but it really is a wonderful place to play. And the one thing that he focused on more than anything else was preparation, being ready to play. Big difference between game days and off days. And he really put pressure on the coaches for that. He wanted the computer shut, walking around, spending time with players. But preparation, and you're not lying. Like, he goes in the locker room team periods and he doesn't leave. Like, so you go in there 6-8 minute mark, you stay in there with the players and he's spitting on the floor and punching guys and making sure they're ready, reminding little details all the time. But he has this ability. He's one of the sharpest guys that I've ever coached with, and Craig Berube is a lot like that as well. There's certain guys that you work with that when they watch the game, they see everything. And Daryl's one of those guys. You know, you might, I've been with coaches where you say something, they got to watch the video three times. Okay, oh, now I know what you're talking about. He sees it all. He sees anything happen out there, mischeck, guy pulling up, where he should have been, what the goalie's doing, the goalie's not where he's supposed to be. Like, he sees it all. It's amazing just how intelligent of a hockey mind he is and how quick-witted he is. I tell young coaches, if you want to learn, because you got to deal with the media at the NHL level, watch Daryl's press conferences.
Yes.
He's a master.
Oh my God.
He controls it. Some of those guys are afraid to ask him questions, and then it'd be funny when you think he's not going to be funny, and he'd be serious when you think he's going to be joking.
Yeah, 100%.
And he'll stick up for his team when he should. And he'll call him out when he shouldn't. And like last year in Calgary, their goalie was awful, so he sent the goalie coach to the press conference.
You know? Yeah, brilliant.
But, did he really?
Oh, he's unreal. Oh, but he keeps everybody on their toes. But I can tell you this, because I worked with him for 8 years, it's always about winning, and it's always for the team. And my stories are endless, right? I can remember we were playing in St. Louis one night, and Matt Green, who I love. Matt Green's just the ultimate team guy. And he's out there beating the puck up. So I'm standing out the DN. Greener comes off and sits down the bench. All of a sudden, I see the stick come flying over like a javelin. And it goes right by my ear and lands in front of Greener on the bench. He goes, "Try that one." So, and then walks away, right? So Greener just grabs the stick and hands it to me and then gets ready for the next shift, right? But there's always stuff like that, you know, where stuff was going on, or if something happened on the back end, I would go turn and walk to my right and he'd be standing right there. You know, like, basically letting you know, like, what the hell is going on there.
Yeah.
And don't, God forbid, you ever get too many men on the ice penalty, which it didn't get many. I'd grab guys by the shoulder many times.
Yeah.
But he would not be happy. How hard can it be? You get three lefts and three rights.
Yeah, right? Yeah, right.
So some of the stuff is obvious. But the biggest thing from him, what he pushed all the time, high, high intensity, but preparation was a big responsibility of the athlete, and preparation was a big responsibility of the coaches to make sure the guys were prepared and ready to play. And I'll guarantee you're going to find that with Torts, right? The game is intense, you know. And I know for Rouse was different because you had to worry about fighting all the time, but it's an intense environment. And you can't go out there loosey-goosey. You go out there relaxed in terms of knowing you have the confidence to be a good player. But you have to get yourself in a mind space where you're ready to perform, because the game is fast. Things happen quickly. You have to go through a mental preparation to kind of think through scenarios or you'll be ready for them. And Daryl was all about that. And he didn't mind. You could take your time off. You give guys lots of time off, lots of rest. You know, enjoy where you live in Southern California and all that. But game day was game day. Where you were in the standings mattered. And it mattered every day. And I love that about him, as something that had a big impact on my philosophy as a coach.
I love that.
That's awesome.
And his sarcasm, obviously, is humorous, you know, from outsider's perspective. Yeah. Like, how do the guys take that? You know, when he throws a stick like that at Matt Green, like, it's obviously funny, right? Like, he gets the point. You're right, yeah. Greener, but like, you guys must think that, like, is when it's not happening to them, that it's, you know, it's kind of loosening them up a bit, maybe, or maybe not.
Well, I'll be honest, I think I said it earlier, guys want to be pushed, and I'll share a story with you, and it kind of maybe is the test of hopefully the relationships that I build and we build as coaches. But when I run into players that I was in LA with, I get a big hug, you know, like we're bonded. Same right. thing when yeah. I see you, Riles. Yeah. If I see Josh Gratton, if I see Mike Richards, Jeff Carter, you know, there's a relationship there that's deep, right? And I ran into Trevor Lewis, and he came to see me after we played Calgary and Dallas this year. So I was talking to Louis, and then Luch comes by. Oh. Milan Lucic, who we had in L.A. for a while, gives me a big hug. And he starts talking to me because Luch had gone to Edmonton and kind of lost his way. And he said, you know, Johnny, he goes, I got playing for Daryl again. And he goes, it's just so simple. He goes, I started worrying about points again and how I was playing. He goes, he just brought it all back to the team. Mm. You know, he just brought it back. Like, what are you going to do to help the team? And how are you going to make the team better? And Daryl has this ability to make everybody feel important. Doesn't matter if you're a fourth line guy. And I like to think that's something that I've learned from being in the Flyers organization over the years, that, you know, even if a guy is playing 8 minutes on the fourth line or 10 minutes like you were, if we didn't have you, we'd be in trouble. Like, the impact you had on the game was as big an impact as somebody who's playing 18 or 20 minutes. And Daryl has the ability to do that. He makes sure the stars are held accountable, and the foot soldiers love that, right? Yeah. If you look at what happened with Johnny Gaudreau last year in Calgary, he had the year of his life.
Yeah, right.
And I wasn't sure Johnny and Daryl would get along. I talked to Daryl about 2 months into the season. He loved him.
Yeah.
How hard he competed. And he said, you know, we got big guys to take care of him. Daryl knew. Yeah. They had good Branson and Zadorov and Lucic and Richie and all these guys that if they try to take liberties on Johnny, that the guys knew that. But he fosters this environment where you got to do your job for the team. It's not about you. And it did, you know, some of those guys are having big years and it started becoming about them. That drives them crazy, right?
Yeah.
They lost their way a little bit at the end of the year. And Daryl, for him, it's simple, right? You know, guys start thinking about themselves. And he always say, if there's a selfish guy in the room, we got to get him out. And he said, that selfish guy in the room is me. Guy's thinking about me, right? We got to get that guy out of the room so we can start being a good team again. So that's the way he's wired. He's all about what's doing what's right for the team, whether you're a star making $10 million or you're a call-up guy. You have to be committed to doing what's best for the team, and you got to check, and you got to have a foundation to check, and everything else will fall into place. And he does not go away on that.
No, I can see that.
That's awesome.
It's funny you mentioned Lucic, because I think I mentioned to you like this past year, like it's almost like he like reinvented himself. He was banging, he was fighting, you know what I mean? And we said, like, geez, something's lit this guy up. And then we've heard that Johnny loved Daryl as well. So,
he was telling me. Yeah, really, so the feeling was mutual.
But you know, if you don't get these inside scoops, you're not really sure, because you know, from an outsider's perspective, from the media presents him to be, you know, get the sour face, sarcastic, and you know, and obviously he's different with the guys in the locker room. But
oh yeah, I've seen him though. Again, just to give you an idea, I'm not sure if it's been a playoff game, but very, very well could have been. I've been in tie hockey games, third period, 2-2, and we get a power play, and you put the fourth line on the ice because the top guys were awful that night. You go, you know what? Our fourth line can do what you guys do. We can go bat around for 2 minutes, take 2 minutes off the clock. So why do you guys big shots think you need to go over the boards because we got a power play? So he'd put the fourth line out, and no disrespect to Colin Fraser and those guys, but
right.
You know, chance of them scoring on the power play was not very high, but he didn't care. He thought holding them accountable for that was more important than the power play, and he was right. You know, at the end of the day, power play is going to come through and score big goals at key times. But if all we focus on the power play and that's your given right to just climb over the boards because we got a penalty and you're not working hard enough to be on it, you're not winning any puck battles, then why should we put you out there?
Right.
And that's he was great about that. You know, he had a great feel for the bench, and he would have no problem to lose a battle, win the war, right?
Yeah.
And he'd do that all the time, and I think it paid big dividends down the road in terms of accountability for everyone.
That's awesome.
Sure.
Chief told us a couple stories about him too. With one was with Igenla real quick, and Conroy, was that who he played with? They had that line. I can't remember the other winger. I never can remember, or the other player on that line. But he said the one night they hadn't been very good, and the third period started, and they had a horrendous shift, and they came off, and Daryl went over and put his arms around him and said, "Hey boys, you know what? I'm gonna let you take the rest of the night off. It's hard out there. It's a tough game. You guys just sit right here. Never put them back on the ice." But so sarcastic, you know, it's tough out there. I get it. You just sit right here, and you know, you
have
take
a little
the rest.
Rest
of the night. It's so fucking funny, man.
That's pretty good.
You know what? You just triggered a thought in my mind here, because and Drew Doughty is an elite talent.
Yeah,
but he's got unbelievable passion for the game. But his emotions get the best of him sometimes, and he is a little bit all over the ice. So it was the first year Daryl had taken over. I was kind of in the D, and he used to yell down the bench, like, call Big Shot or Fancy Pants. And he never called him by his name, but it would drive Drew crazy because he figured he was referring to him, right? So Drew has this shift where he's all over the map, and it's a neutral zone faceoff. So Drew comes to the bench, and Daryl comes on and goes, no. You go back. You go play right wing. And Drew's like, what? He goes, no. So he tries to get up. He goes, no. You got this game all figured out. Go play right wing. So now Drew's losing his mind, right, because Daryl's making him go out and play right wing. So he lines up for the faceoff. Puck drops, comes straight to the bench and changes, right? And now he's banging a stick and slamming. But, and the guys loved it because – and Drew was. He's, some of those nights, he didn't know what position he's playing. He's all over the place. But, I mean, he's a difference maker. Trust me, Drew Doughty is the best defender I've ever had. People think they don't understand about Drew is how good he defends and how much he cares about it.
Yeah.
Like, he's just – he's so gifted with the puck and the way he moves the puck and sees the game. But he's a winner. Like, when the game's on the line, he makes a difference. He can tilt us. If two teams are even, he can be the difference maker. So, and I think Daryl knew that. So I think he knew that here's this young guy. Because Drew was a star before I got there, before Daryl got there. He'd won a gold medal with Canada.
Right.
He was a runner-up for the Norris.
Right.
But we all saw that he had a lot further to go if he was going to win. So anyway, Daryl had his way
of getting to him
there. So, obviously, Drew had some great years for him and had won two cups playing for him. And
yeah, he was
I'm sure he's got a lot of respect
right?
for him.
Johnny,
Like
I always noticed, like I was able to meet him a few times with Richie and those guys and have a couple beers with him and everything. He was hilarious. But I always noticed on the ice, you could always hear him. He would be chirping our bench, like, you know, when I was at the Flyers, and he would be there and someone would say something. He'd just turn around and he'd just be chirping guys. Like, and I was just like, I love this, man. Like, I kind of miss that because it's not as prevalent as it was before. But he's a competitor and a hell of a player. You're right.
Yeah. I was going to say, you mentioned, like, the emotional part of Doughty, but, like, I was talking to Nassie. Like, there's one thing I remember about you as my coach, and, like, there was this level of professionalism. But the way you held yourself behind the bench, I always thought of it as, like, a sign of strength. Like, you know, like, emotion, it's an emotional game, obviously. It's easy to blow up, and, you know, one little thing happens, you know, a puck slips off a stick, turnover, you know, you can blow up 100 times a game. I always thought it was, like, awesome how you held your composure, and I took that, you know, into my personal life and, like, as a one of those, like, learnings, you know, working under you. But I know, like, Philly fans, you know, you have Hackstall coming in after, and it's almost like they don't understand how to control, you know, the ability to control emotion, and they always want to see blow-ups because it's entertaining, you know. But, like, can you talk to maybe, like, the importance of that, because that trickles over to your players, no question.
It's a great point, Riles, and I'll be honest with you, when I've gone to job interviews, it's something I have to address, because you're not rah-rah. But when they get to know me, and you guys know me, the quiet intensity and passion I have controlled to me is way more important than an outburst that is meaningless, right?
Sure.
And I think when I first started coaching, it wasn't always that way. And the lesson I learned for me, and I think you have to self-reflect, we were playing, I don't know if it was my first year, it might have been, but we were playing first or second year. No, we were trying to make the playoffs, and we were playing Norfolk, and it was a team we were fighting with. So it's a game where there's not any much scoring chances either end. And there was a play that happened on the ice where a guy high-stuck a guy. So I stuck Derek. So it was clearly a penalty. But then you're on Derek's team, and at the end of the whistle, somehow you got cut on a totally unrelated play. Well, they remembered the high stick, and they thought it was that was the one that cut you, but it was not. So right. In the minors, it's 5 minutes, not four. Right. It's a five-minute major. So I'm trying to get a hold of the referee saying, you got the wrong guy. Like, yes, it's a penalty, but they don't want to talk to you. So now, and it's a 1-1 game. We got to win the game. Like, it's neck and neck. Norfolk's the team we're fighting with. So I'm stuck on this. I go, get the wrong guy. Like, what are you doing? We get the wrong guy. So the puck drops, and they go by the bench, and Pete Vandermeer was on our team. And as the referee skates by, Pete goes, you got the wrong guy. And turns around, gives a bench minor. So now we're down 5-on-3 for 2 minutes because it's a five-minute major.
Oh,
so I'm thinking, how can you make a call? So now I'm flipping out. How can you make a call like that? It's a 1-1 game. You can make a call. So then what do you think happened? They scored on the power play. We lose 2-1. We get on the bus. We're in Norfolk. Go to Cincinnati. And I'm sitting there thinking about what happened. So I was thinking, if I'm a player sitting there watching me do this, right, saying, how can you make that call? What am I telling my players? I'm telling them we're in trouble. I'm telling my players we're going to get scored on. And I'm telling them that penalty is going to make the difference in the game. Instead of saying nothing, if the referee's got a problem, say something. But then focus on killing the penalty, right? Okay, 5-minute major, keep the shift short. you know, we want to lose lots of bodies. Every time there's a clear, let's get fresh people out there so you don't get caught, whatever it is, right?
Yeah.
Right. And I always look back. So there's a saying that I go by when it comes to that is a frightened captain makes for a frightened crew. So if 100%. The captain's losing his mind on the ship, everyone's getting nervous, right? So I've always tried to remember that, and it's a good reminder for me. Okay, so you can't change the call. You can waste a lot of energy on a referee, or can you focus on what needs to get done here? And I've always tried to focus on what needs to get done and save your energy and to maybe communicate with the players on the bench instead of having this outburst that's not going to mean anything except, you know, putting on a show for the fans or maybe feeling a little bit better for 10 seconds but doesn't accomplish anything, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's good insight. So I just wanted to finish on that is, like, it wasn't like you didn't show emotion because, like, you know, between periods,
yeah.
the eyes would go squirrely, you know, when the time was right.
Yeah.
And there'd be some sticks breaking and whatever else, right? I mean, but, like, I felt like on the bench, you did a good job of holding your composure.
Yeah,
I learned a 100%. Lot from that because to your little quote there, that's exactly it, right? I mean, your players are just a reflection of you in a sense, right? I mean, how you carry yourself and is how they're going to generally carry themselves. Maybe besides Boyd Kane, but
the quietest guy in the world, and they yelled at the refs from the time the puck dropped till it was over. Never seen anything like it. Did it not blow your mind? He was the quietest guy, man.
Do you remember what we did with Johnny Way the one time?
No.
It was Locko. He was his helper in the room. He just wouldn't stay off the referees. And we actually had Kerry Fraser come in that year and talk to the team, just related to, you know, these guys are people. They're trying to do a good job. So we came in for the pregame meeting, and I had Johnny. I got a referee's jersey. So we walk into the dress team for the game. I bring Johnny Way in, stand in the middle of the room. I said, Kaner, go ahead. Get it out. I made him start yelling at Johnny Way. And he kind of got the match, but he couldn't help it.
Yeah, he could not.
But the good thing about it was his passion was so – like you talk about net drive.
Right?
You talk about going to the net hard. Like, if you touch Boyd Kane around, he's 228 pounds, unbelievable.
Yeah.
But if you touch him around the goalie, he would lose all his weight and flop on the goalie and fall into the goalie. But he was around the net all the time. He played a heavy, heavy game. I don't know if you guys remember.
He could hit.
He could hit.
He played on line with Mike Richards and Johnny Sim at the end of that playoff run, and they were phenomenal. Scored big goals.
Yeah.
Could check against anybody. And big hits just changed the complexion of the game all the time. So there's a little bit of a – there's a line there you try and find, and Drew Doughty has that line, right? Same thing. He's an emotional guy that outbursts all the time, but you don't want to take that away from him because his passion, what makes him great, right?
Right.
He gets himself into trouble with the referees all the time, but he's a great player. I mean, he's probably one of the greatest defensemen in the game for the last 10 years, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And I think that passion's got a lot to do with it. So you try and harness as he gets older to kind of make it more productive, but you don't want to lose it either.
Yeah, right.
So that's a fine line you got to walk.
Yeah, exactly. We actually recorded with Tony D'Angelo yesterday, and we actually had this exact conversation around, like, as he's matured over the years, how he's been able to navigate his emotion and you know, focus it and redirect it in a more positive fashion. So,
I think the Flyer fans are going to love this kid.
Exactly.
I've known him since he's 2 years old, and I'll just share this quick story about Ant. I know the family really well, and we skate in the summertime. I run the skates, so you know, you get down there at 7 o'clock in the morning, the kids are tired, you're in the locker room, they're kind of getting dressed, it's quiet in there. Well, the days he's there, totally different. The locker room is a buzz. He's telling stories, guys are laughing, like there's so much energy in the room. The guys love him, and he's unreal. Comes on the ice, works hard, he's an elite talent. I mean, he's got offensive ability that it's hard to teach. He's an extremely strong competitor. I know he's got his passions gotten away with him a little bit in the past, but I mean, if you look at the years he's had, especially last year in Carolina on a team that was legitimately a Stanley Cup contender, he's a good player and he will bring some attitude to that team. You know, I think the Flyers, any team that struggles, I think they lose their identity a little bit.
Yeah,
I think he'll, along with Torts, he'll help bring some of that back.
Yeah, that's exactly what we were saying. And, you know, after he had left and we'd wrapped up, we're like, I love this guy. He's like, he's so Philly. You know, he's got the right attitude. He's the energy you're talking about in the locker room, he brought in here. I mean, he was like, I feel like I'd known the guy for like 10 years, you know, and just talking, telling stories.
He was here early. We'd shot the show, and then he hung around almost an hour, and we were just shooting the shit, and it was awesome. It was really good.
But, it'd be nice for him to come back to Philly and bring that emotion. I mean, you said the identity.
At
least bring that energy, that fight. You know, that fight, just that hard, you know, that hard guy to play against, you know, that emotional guy.
And the Flyer fans love that kind of hockey, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, no doubt.
Johnny, I know there's something you want to correct here. from one of our episodes with Andy Delmore, and I may have screwed the story up, so I'll take the blame. But we were telling a story about one time he threw his gear in the shower because he didn't hang it, and I usually remember stuff pretty well, but I now that you told me something earlier, but
you're making excuses for him, I think.
Yeah, I was making excuses for him, but let Johnny, you tell your side of the story here.
Yeah. Well, just to give a little background of the whole thing, we used to practice at Hollydale, and you had to take everything upstairs. So we went to Hershey for a road trip. So we get home early, and if we just left the trainers do it, they'd be there for 3 hours. But if we just all chipped in for 10 minutes, it'd literally take 10 minutes and save you guys a couple hours of work. So we get home, we would take all the bags, and there was an elevator for the heavy stuff, I believe. Yep. But we'd bring our bags upstairs, put them in our stalls, unpack them so they'd dry, and it would literally take 10 minutes and be on your way. And I was a veteran guy that had Andy Delmore, who was a young kid, extremely talented, but not totally dialed into being a good pro yet. He sat next to me in the locker room, so I'm unpacking my bag, and you're unpacking his bag next to me, and I'm like, well, what are you doing? He's like, Deli had to go. I said, why isn't Deli doing? He goes, oh, they're trying to make last call at Ott's. It's a little pub around the corner, right?
I just threw him right under the bus, obviously. I said, sorry, Deli.
I said, what? I said, you leave that bag alone and get me a shopping cart. So I put his stuff in a hockey bag. So we had practice in the morning, pushed it in the shower, opened it up, turned the shower on, went back, finished unpacking my bag, come back and unpack and zipped it up and left it in the shower.
He said,
and
don't you touch that
bag. Don't touch it. And when he comes in the morning, you tell him, come see me. So he comes in the morning looking for his equipment, and he said, you go see Johnny. So I brought him in the shower, and it was, I said, don't give me any dry stuff either. I said, so I asked him what happened. He goes, well, you know, we're trying to make last call. I said, well, really, it took you 10 minutes. You couldn't take 10 minutes?
Yeah.
So anyway, that was the story. Derek thought he was just helping out somewhere else in the building, when really he'd scooted out to make last call at Ott's because we just got back from Hershey, and he was skirting the issue of trying to toe a line with what he was supposed to do to help out. So
yeah,
it was a good lesson for Deli.
It was.
He ended up becoming a really good pro and having a good career, and he was on the team, the cup team we won in 98.
Yeah.
There's another young guy that was a big contributor in a pressure-packed situation, but you know, he wasn't always that way, and I think there's some things we need to fix with Deli, right?
Yeah, right.
There was. I remember, too, Johnny, just talking about a little bit about your composure, even as a player. I remember Deli would always, he was doing stupid shit all the time, right? He was a kid. I was a kid then, too, but he was a young kid, and there was a couple times, I can't remember exactly what he had done, but he did something stupid, like, and it pissed me off, and I remember you just turn around at me going like that, and I'm like, oh, okay, all right. Yeah, man, yeah. I need to calm down, you know, like, because I'm so hyper anyway, but something just popped in my head. What was it?
Billy was hard on him.
Yeah, but yeah. Well, that was I was gonna.
Half my job was settling Deli down to stop shaking after Billy yelled at him. Yeah.
But I was gonna say, it was so funny. Billy was so hard on Dave McIsaac, and you know, Mac. There's a timeout, like they were radio timeouts, or sometimes, like Johnny had said, we were on TV too, and they would throw AC/DC on, and here's Mac,
like, air guitar.
Yeah. And I'm like, I'm kind of chuckling at him because he's looking at me doing it. And I like turn to one time and Billy goes, that's you. That's you, Delio. You got to fucking cut it out. I'm like, I'm not the one on the ice dancing around. But I'll never forget, Johnny, when we were playing in that series against Hershey, we swept them. And it was huge. I think, did we start on the road? Did we start that series on the road or we started home?
No, because we finished in Hershey.
That's right. So I remember we ended up winning the game 2 in overtime. And I remember Kosher saying, let's win this game, and we're going to go up there, and we're gonna sweep these motherfuckers. And but it was funny. Mac took a puck, and he was so hot that series, especially. Remember, he had scored, like, I think he scored, like, every game in that series. And Billy was always so hard on him for good reason. You know, Mac was a little bit of a wild card. But I remember Billy being on the phone, and I don't know who he was talking to, but after the 90, he took that puck, and he was always hard on Mac, and he goes, I heard him on the phone say, our best player got hurt last night. I'm like, best player? When did Mac become our best player? But it was so funny. But Mac was hot. He had a great playoff. Everyone did, but that made me laugh thinking about that with Mac. But Billy was hard on Mac. And another thing, Johnny, like, remember, jog my memory there with Kosher. I remember Kosher after our first game we played at home. I think we played Rochester, if I'm not mistaken, the first game. You scored the first goal in Phantoms history, too. But we were winning the game 2-1, Riggs. And the place is pretty much packed, right? It was close. It was like, you know, half full or whatever. But Kosher's like, I'm taking a face-off in the end, and we're up 2-1. and someone yelled through the lens for the photographer, like, we got the win. Now let's kick their asses. You know, and he goes, it's 2-1 with like a minute to go. The people wanted, oh, yeah, it was so funny. But those are good times. I just, that popped in my head there. It was so funny.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
You still challenging guys on the bike?
I still ride the bike a lot. I can challenge young guys because the young guys come in, their foundation isn't anywhere near what it need to be. So
still doing that. I remember that you just challenge Gratz all the time. And
yeah, you know what? Tony Vogt still lives near.
Tony Vogt,
you could probably tell the story. We were playing. It was the year after we won the cup, and we were probably end up being a 500 team, but we lost like 13 guys a year, almost like we're starting over their prospects. And we were playing a game at home that, again, I thought we had to win to get in the playoffs, and we had Jimmy Campbell.
Oh, no,
Tony Vogt. Jimmy's a great guy.
Yeah.
I was always on him. I wanted to play harder. Yep. And it was the end of a long weekend, and we're day off playing the next day. So I came in after the game and said, listen, we need to get regrouped here. Take the day off, get your rest, except for you two guys. You're going to meet me on the bike tomorrow morning. And they had this ride we used to do, and it was brutal. It's hard. And I wasn't that far from playing, so I could still put up a really good score. So we go to the rink the next day. Jimmy Campbell was determined to beat me. So he's racing out front, but it was a 30-minute ride. So if you went too hard, you couldn't finish the ride. You have to stop. So he's sprinting, and then he's resting. He's sprinting, he's resting. But Tony didn't even try. Tony just said, I'm just going to spin my wheels. So we finished the ride, and I crushed Jimmy, even though I gave him credit because he tried. He's laying on the ground, gasping for air. But Tony didn't even try, so we made Tony ride another half hour because he didn't even try. But back then, you could do that. Now the guys are so well-conditioned. Unless the young guys come in. Like, the young guys come in, I don't think they have any idea the level of fitness of the veteran guys and what's needed to play the game at that level every night.
Yeah,
you're playing 82 games with travel, the way guys take care of themselves. I think it's a real eye-opener for young guys. So, I mean, if we go to development camp, those things, yeah, I think I can hold my own. But the guys that are the seasoned veterans, I think I'm way back of the line now.
Yeah, that's hilarious.
I remember you just made me remember something else, Johnny, when we had Soupy. Like, Johnny was like, Soupy was all over the map.
I love Soupy.
But he was so funny. And I remember he got suspended for something. He did something. And we're going, like, he was always hanging around in his laundry anyway, right? Like, so he was like, he wasn't playing. And all of a sudden, we're going down to the ice. And here comes Flax leads him out. And I'm like, dude, Ari, I think was the name of the kid. I'm like, he ain't that tough. I'm like, oh, my God. That's Soupy. He put the Flax
outfit on. I remember that.
And led it, and the guys were crying. I remember you saying to me, is that Soupy or something?
I didn't find out till after the game. He high-fived me going to the bench. Good luck, coach. But then when you guys told me that, I went back, looked at the video, and he had those CCM skates with the white.
That's a good memory.
Oh, my God. It was so funny.
You could tell the stride difference. It was Mike Hart, was it not?
Oh, was it Mike Hart then?
Well, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I thought it was there was one kid that they had. It was just he was there 1 year, and he was, like, high 24/7.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
And he was the guy. He was dancing, and one of the Hershey fans punched him. I don't know if you remember, like, punched him, and the Flax mask turned, and the guy's just feeding him, and all you see is his head going back like this, because he did something to the fan, a Hershey fan, that pissed him off. But he was the same kid, like, a few weeks later that skated out, and he wasn't paying attention. The Zamboni hit him, and it hooked onto his cape, and it was dragging him.
Come on.
He heard it. I swear to God, man, he was like, he was high 24/7, this guy. I think his name was Ari. I think that was his name, but anyway.
Whatever. I like to think people could pick out the stride difference between Jimmy Campbell and Flax.
That was funny.
That was priceless. Funny. He was a character because that was probably his last year playing, was he not? He was Soupy, right?
Funny, the next game I thought he played great.
Yeah.
And I went down the bench and his face was completely red and I tapped him on the shoulder. He turned around and I go, it's hard playing the game the right way, isn't it? And he goes,
yeah, right. Oh, man, that's pretty
awesome,
good.
Man.
He was great, though. He was a fun guy, and he was a good player. And
he certainly loosened up the locker room when we got him.
He was fun to be around. Yeah. Oh, man.
Anything else, Nast?
I think that's it, man. With Johnny, we really appreciate you coming on. We could sit here and talk for hours and tell stories, but you've been unbelievable for him and I, and you're an unbelievable person, one of the best people I've met in hockey. That's 100% sure, and we thank you for coming, taking the time with us today.
Well, thank you guys, and I tell you what, this you guys are special to me, too. The Flyers organization is something that's been really special to me and my family. I think, you know, the old saying, once a Flyer, always a Flyer.
Yep.
And, you know, winning cups here with you, Derek, we've done that twice. And Rouse, the impact you had on our team, it's not surprising. There's so many people that are still living in the area and are affiliated with the organization because it has a huge impact on all of us. So I appreciate coming on. It's good keeping in touch with you guys and love what you're doing. So lots of luck in the future.
Thank you.
Thanks, Johnny. Appreciate it.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to Amazon.com/sports ad free. That's Amazon.com/sports ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.